everyone, and welcome to the Belt and Road podcast, where we bring you the latest news, research, and analysis of China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Juliette Liu, and I'm currently recovering from a week of intensive Christmas cookie consumption here in Ithaca, New York. I'm joined, as always, by Eric Maestrino. Eric, how are you doing?
I am not recovering from cookie consumption, but I'm certainly recovering from from late night video caroling is after a few too many jolly drinks. But that was a really fun evening.
So. It's a great idea.
Doing well, yeah. Actually.
Been thriving under COVID. Yes. I'll take this chance to remind our listeners to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Belt and Road Pod, and we regularly post new news and discussion. It's a great way to get updates on everything that's happening with Chinese investments and other types of engagements overseas.
As we often note, you know, the dominant narratives of the Belt and Road Initiative tend to be very state-centric, and they have a strong focus on China, sometimes even often as a trade as a unitary or at least incredibly powerful actor. And it rarely discusses recipient countries' agency or the political economic context in which Chinese entities are coming within. And often when there is a global context given, and this is particularly true within the American media context, the narrative or research focuses on China-US competition is playing out within different regions of a Belt and Road country. What often is missing within these narratives are the importance of other major regional powers and how their institutions, histories, and systems of infrastructure diplomacy interact, compete, and sometimes cooperate with Chinese state entities within Belt and Road countries. Nowhere is this more true than in Southeast Asia, where both Japan and South Korea have large, complex, and influential relations with many of the countries in the region. A fact that seems to surprise many people when I tell them is that even after the Belt and Road Initiative, Japan has been and continues to be the largest provider of export credit for infrastructure within ASEAN. That's one of the many reasons why, actually, today I'm very excited to have on the show today Dr. Jessica Liao. Jessica has two recent publications that we will discuss today. First is out of the November issue of Global Policy. It's the Club-Based Climate Regime and OECD Negotiations on Restricted Coal Fire Export Finance Global Policy. And the second is from the wonderful PandaPod Dragon Claw, the December blog post that's called Easy Money and Political Opportunism, How China and Japan's High-Speed Rail Competition in Indonesia Drives Financially Risky Projects. Dr. Jessica Liao is an assistant professor of political science at North Carolina State University and is a Wilson China Fellow. And most importantly, at least to me, Jessica, for 2 years, was my advisor as I was her teacher's assistant at North Carolina State University. She is a good friend. I've been trying to get her on the show for years now. So I'm so excited, Jessica, to have you on the show. Welcome to the Belt and Road podcast.
Thank you so much, Eric.
So the first question that we wanted to start off with is from your global policy paper. Your paper focuses on negotiations between the US, China, Japan, and South Korea on export credit agencies. Throughout the last few decades, each country uses kind of their export credit regime very heavily. Give us a little bit of background on these export credit agencies and how the ECAs in the US, China, Japan, and South Korea kind of have similar but also contrasting structures and goals.
Sure. So export credit agencies, ECA that we call, are a type of financial instrument that primarily serves exporters who sell capital-intensive goods and services that require medium and long-term capital, such as mechanical equipment or infrastructure construction. And because the private export finance in this category is usually very difficult to obtain, because, you know, it takes a long time to recoup the interest. So that is usually something that the private finance market is not interested in. So ECAs are also important for exporters doing business in developing countries. Why? Because those countries usually carry higher financial risk and, you know, are often beyond the tolerance threshold of private financiers. And ECAs are unique because of their public or semi-public functions. So how do they work? They borrow from the national treasury or public capital markets and use those funds, technically subsidies, to finance exporters. So they have been a common instrument for governments to help exporters compete in global markets. So, and you can probably imagine who are the heavy users of ECAs. Of course, are countries or governments of the countries who are, you know, export oriented. And so that is why when we talk about ECAs, we always talk about, like, you know, those East Asian export oriented countries. In the past, Japan and South Korea are the government, their governments are the one use, you know, most ECAs to promote the rapid growth of their export sectors. And then in now, especially since 2000, after China entered the World Trade Organization and very quickly surged to the top, you know, exporters in the world. And you see the Chinese export credit agencies also become the largest in the world. And so these three countries are actually the China, Japan, and South Korea's ECAs are actually among the top 10 largest exporters in the world and also operate some of the largest ECAs. And they are similar in their operation and providing export credit products of various lengths and terms. China, Japan, and South Korea, they are among the top 10 largest exporters in the world. So, of course, they also operate some of the largest ECAs. And they are similar in their operation, which is they provide export credit products such as, you know, buyer's credit or, you know, export credits to the exporters on various lengths and terms, and sometimes credit and underwriting services. And the biggest differences among their ECAs are for Japan and South Korea, they are under more restrictions than China because their operations are under the restrictions of Organization of for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, which is also known as the Rich Countries Club. So Japan and South Korea's export credit agencies, they have to annually submit their operation reports and also give out a very transparent information of how their ECA operates, where China is a new player in the ECA market. So that is also not part of the OECD club. And therefore, it does not have to comply with the OECD rules. So that also gives them more flexibility of the terms and also the lengths and how they operate. Now they have higher autonomy than the counterpart in Japan and South Korea that also provide them more competitive advantage. That is a very important reason why Chinese ECAs rose up so rapidly in export credit markets.
Jessica, that's great. That's really clear. And so if we were, you know, for any of the people in our audience who are very less exposed to economic stuff like myself, basically these ECAs are the link between the government and exporters, the credit link where the government actually provides credit, pushing and enabling exporters to do XYZ, sometimes linked to political goals, but a lot of times just in terms of helping those exporters function abroad where it's where they're exposed to more risk and fluctuations.
That's right. Yeah. And you make a great point about the ECA's, you know, functions serving both political and market interests. A lot of time it's really about statecraft purpose because of the subsidies that ECA rely on in its operations. A lot of time the government would consider, oh, this is a very important ally so that we have to give them, you know, extra finance. So they use that to help and to bridge the relationship. But in a lot of most cases, I would say, is actually more of a market functions because, you know, ECA in its operation is sort of just like a bank, right? So it depends on who are actually going to the bank to borrow money. And those are exporters. So exporters, they operate based on the market functions. So when they cannot find the private finance for their export products, then they go to ECAs and find the other options. So that's why you see a lot of, you know, big machine exporters or like construction firms, they are, you know, looking for like loan or credit or underwriting services. When they cannot find like, you know, loans from like, say, Citibank or Bank of America, that will say, okay, this is the kind of services or products that they probably are eligible for the Ex-Im Bank to provide their services through. And then, therefore, they go to ECAs, and then the ECAs operate based on the subsidies from the Treasury Department. There you go. You have this kind of like public and private interest all infused.
So your first paper on these export credit agencies and negotiations that happened at the OECD during the Obama administration on financing export credit agencies, financing coal power plants. Can you give a background on the role that export credit agencies from China, Japan, South Korea, and elsewhere have played in the development of coal power plants in the 20th and 21st century? Who are the major players within it, and where are they invested?
So before I jump into talking about the competitions between China, Japan, and South Korea, I will talk a little bit about why it's important to talk about ECAs and its rules on environmental protection. Well, ECAs are important to the environmental protections in developing countries. Why? Because those countries have long relied on the import of technology and capital from developed countries for large-scale development. And those large-scale development, a lot of it is really about energy supply. So to that end, the OECD country has increasingly expanded and updated rules for their ECAs, resulting in the adoption of common approaches, environmental and social due diligence in the late 1990s and in early 2000s. And so the common approaches on environmental and social due diligence is really trying to move the bar of environmental protections for those ECAs when evaluating their loan applications, how their borrowers are able to comply with not just the local environmental regulations in those developing countries, but even the higher standards, what we usually know as the Equator Principle, that is applied to, you know, one of the most common best practice in environmental protection and assessment, and the due diligence process that is very important to assess those parts in order to ensure borrowers and also the construction providers are really implementing the higher standard of the environmental protection. And so the ECAs of the OECD countries have been trying to use common approaches to ensure the ECAs are also compliant with those rules. And from 2000 onwards, the OECD countries have turned their efforts in greening their ECAs to climate change. So those, they updated the rules for, you know, some of the energy and energy-related projects. Still, changes on the OECD's ECA rules are primarily giving out incentives for renewable exports rather than giving out restrictions on carbon-intensive exports. So what does that mean? They're really trying to focus on how to help those renewable energy sector or renewable exporters to expand markets in developing countries. But then they really do not do enough restrictions on financing carbon-intensive exports. What are we talking about? Coal-fired power plants, you know, the cheapest options for developing countries to access to energy supply, is also one of the largest categories over the past two decades or so that the ECA are actually financing. So it is a really big problem because we all know coal-fired power plants are actually the largest source of the greenhouse emitters in the world now. So, and OECDs are really trying to steer their ECAs away from financing the coal-fired power plant. But it is also very difficult because a lot of time the ECAs are operating based on the market rules. That means they cannot choose their borrowers. The borrowers choose them, right? They don't go to, you know, ask like who wants, you know, the finance or and all that. It's the exporters, right? Go to their door and say, hey, we have these applications, we need money. And if the developing countries or if those coal power or coal technology exporters are looking for, you know, any kind of financing options, they are the one going to ECAs and say like, hey, we have this deal to the developing country A, and then we need this support. And here are my loan applications and, you know, and all the market information they need to know. So simply put, because ECAs operate under the market influence, so their lending follows demands of developing countries, which continue to favor energy projects of low cost and proven technologies such as coal-fired power, LBI, high carbon intensity, and environmental costs on their side. So as a result, OECD ECAs continue to support fossil fuel-based power projects, even though such support under the regulations of the common approaches has declined over the years. So who are the biggest players? And then we have to turn to these three countries. So Japan and South Korea in history, they are the biggest players in financing the coal-fired power plants overseas. Because why? Again, it's the market, you know, rule, right? Because these two countries are also the leaders of the coal power technologies. And these two countries, like I was talking about earlier, because of their, you know, rapid industrialization and export-oriented history in their economies, their coal-fired power technologies are also the most competitive global-wide. So for a long time, their ECAs financed a huge chunk of money to their coal technology exporters. But then the landscape started to change since 2000s when Chinese export credit agencies are doing very heavy lifting to help their coal technologies going out and compete with these two traditional players. So the three countries and their ECAs finance a majority of the overseas and their developing countries' coal-fired power plants in the past two decades. And they invested in developing countries across Africa, Latin America, South and the Southeast Asia. And according to Global Energy Monitor, India, Indonesia, and Vietnam, since 2010 in particular, have received the largest capital for their respective coal power industries. And a lot of them are all multi-billion dollar, and that we call them like mega coal-fired power plants. And those kind of big power plant projects cannot be realized unless you have like really important private and public finance, the underwriting also as, you know, state guarantee.
In those countries, was that money coming from any export credit agencies or was that China specifically?
I would say for these three countries in particular, most of their monies are really from these three because of the geographic proximity. So they actually go to these three countries for export credit agencies. But if you look at other regions and their coal-fired power development, you will find a combination of more players. For example, Africa. You will see some of the European export credit agencies still have contribution to it, such as contribution from Germany and also from France. They all have financial contributions to the coal-fired power plant in Africa. But of course, if you look at the dollar terms, the money terms, the money contribution from German and also French export credit agencies are still dwarfed by Japan, South Korea, and China. But in terms of the top three coal-fired power plant operators, India, Indonesia, and Vietnam, they are still relying primarily on the three countries, Japan, China, and South Korea's export credit agents.
Great. And you kind of outlined, you know, beyond just coal, even speaking more broadly about these ECAs, OECD countries have been trying to kind of regulate them since the 1970s. Mm-hmm. But then you kind of write that China became the world's largest exporter by 2009. So how has that kind of shifted the way OECD countries regulate their ECAs and also just the general export credit agency landscape globally since China has become so powerful in that realm?
I think this is really important when we talk about like ECAs and also, you know, how China become the largest financier of overseas infrastructure development, especially in developing countries, because a lot of people got confused with what China is doing and Chinese banks are doing overseas with what World Bank and also Asian Development Bank and a lot of multilateral development banks are doing. So what I would say is that is a comparison between apple and oranges. They are in a very different turn and also a different playing field. China is really, like when we're talking about Chinese overseas infrastructure finance, a better comparison is really to compare Chinese banks with all the other countries' export credit agencies. So the arrangement on officially supported export credit agencies are a traditional, the longest international agreement. I don't like to call it agreement because this is not like a treaty. It's more known as a gentleman's agreement among exporters. And when I talk about exporters, I'm talking about the traditional exporters of OECD countries. So this is the most common known agreement among exporters in regulating their, you know, export finance. And for a long time, what is the arrangement trying to do? It's really trying to prevent subsidy wars because that happened before. And we talk about Japan and South Korea or even Germany. So Germany, yeah, let's don't forget Germany is really a big player. Yeah, Germany is the largest exporter in the world for a long time. And so that, you know, it's export credit agency, so it's like incredibly big. So Japan and Germany and even France, and then later South Korea, when they enter OECDs, they are relying heavily on subsidies, and i.e. their ECAs, to compete in the export markets. And for a long time, they do a lot of over-subsidies. And so that very quickly, you know, that hurt every country's, you know, because when you over-subsidize, your treasury actually got a lot of expense. So the arrangement on officially supported export credit agencies are known as a gentleman's agreement that works in regulating OECD ECA's operations. How they work is specify common terms of export lendings from interest and risk premium rates to repayment periods. And over time, OECD countries also revised and expanded the arrangement to prevent cutthroat competition among each other. So basically, and they also created this transparency system and asked, you know, all the ECA to have annual report in order to keep each other in check. So this arrangement has been working very well because all the players understand their reputational cost and trying to comply with the terms, even though this is not a binding treaty. But then the landscape changed since 2000s, especially after 2010. An increasing number of non-OECD countries has established their own ECAs to promote exports. And of course, China, as the largest player of the export markets, have been the top players in the new ECA market, the export credit market. And who are we talking about? So China operates two largest ECAs in the world now, the Export-Import Bank of China, Exim China, and also the China Development Bank, CDB. And also, in addition to this, they also have China Export and Credit Insurance Corporation, Sinosure. They three provide a whole variety of financing products to the Chinese exports. And in 2018, Chinese ECA's own overseas portfolio as large as $39 billion. This amount is larger than the next three ECAs combined. Chinese ECAs are not just influential because of its scale. It's also influential because of how it operates. So Chinese ECAs have offered, in average, lower pricing, longer tenors than OECD ECAs. and make financial arrangements other than traditional export credits. And they created a lot of new financial products that is usually beyond, you know, what the traditional ECA operate. And in addition, they also often mix export credits with foreign aid loans to the degree that is beyond the arrangement's allowance. So this practice, studies found, contribute to Chinese ECA's rapid rise in the world market and also help Chinese exporters gain advantage over their competitors.
Yeah, the idea that the Chinese export credit agencies actually have branched out and even been what innovative financial innovation within the ECA realm as to what they can offer, especially because they're outside of the OECD confines. Right. I'm just curious, and maybe this is a question of ignorance. When I've spoken to some Chinese state-owned enterprise managers who work in Belt and Road countries, they talk about how the FEPC and how that's a great advantage, the financing and then engineering procurement to construction. Right. So being a construction contractor in an infrastructure place, project. Is that a product that, because that's something in which lots of the large infrastructures use, can like Japan's or South Korea's or Turkey's or Germany's, can they also do something similar to a FEPC? Or is that something that, is that what you're talking about, it's unique to China?
Well, it really depends on the value chain, what we're talking about, because the majority of the Chinese exporters are doing what we know as the construction or like contractor jobs, right? So there is a term in Chinese, it's called 代资承包, that means fulfill the contract and with the financing services provided. And that is exactly how the Chinese export credits are supporting. And that is why Chinese players rose so rapidly in the international contracting markets, because how the ECAs operate in such a way to help them to provide like this very comprehensive financial as well as the contracting services. How is it putting competition pressure on the other OECD ECAs, especially Japan and China? So because China is having a lot of a more leeway in terms of how they operate and how they support their exporters. So that really give out a lot of pressure to exporters of other countries who also compete in the same industrial categories. So we're talking specifically like Japan and South Korea, especially in the energy supply sectors. For the arrangements that we're talking about, the OECD arrangements, which for a long time, you know, regulate how the ECA should provide and what kind of financial products that they can provide. So this is a regime, I would say, that still work in its own realm. But if you look larger term, like in the larger financial landscape, you will see this is a regime that is increasingly going obsolete in terms of its real regulatory function. Because of the competition pressure imposed on the Chinese ECAs, you start to see more and more OECD ECAs are also trying to offer terms or financial products that is not under the regulations of the OECD arrangements. And a lot of their financial services that are provided are actually emulating what ECA providers, such as state guarantee. And also there is a market window services. I don't want to go into too much of those financial details, but there are like certain terms that is not under the regulations of the arrangements that you see more and more OECD ECAs are trying to, you know, provide in order for their exporters to gain those extra advantage versus their competitors. And if you look into those non-arrangement cover financial terms, Japan and especially South Korea is actually, you know, are the two ECA operators who are providing the most services to. And the reason is really because they need to keep competition with the Chinese players in order to compete in the international contracting markets.
Yeah, I remember, again, speaking to some contractors at a medium-sized Chinese state-owned enterprise and how they spoke about how easiest ways in which they're trying to drum up business in the contracting market, and what Belt and Road country, whether it be national or regional or just private partners that they found there, was just the fact that, oh, I can call my dude at the China XM Shandong province Zhejiang office, and he can get me the 100 million that's needed for this road or this dam or whatever. So it makes it for a very attractive and easy finance for Belt and Road countries. Your last answer was a great segue to our next question, talking about after 2008, they have the Obama administration. Obama made climate a priority within OECD negotiations. Mm-hmm. And so within that, there was an interest in putting regulations on ECAs and their financing of coal. So who did the U.S. find support within this, and from where and why was there pushback? And how does China figure into this calculation?
Before we talk about Obama's campaign to end overseas coal power finance, we want to really talk about two phases of this campaign. So the first, it started in 2009, but it went down very quickly because it was not really well received overseas, within the OECD countries. And then second phase of the campaign started in 2012. This is also, if you recall, the second term of Obama started with a very strong push for climate policy. And it's not just on the domestic level, it's on the international as well. And this is also the part of the initiative coming out as Obama's push for more global environmental leadership. And one of the initiatives is to end the overseas public finance on the coal-fired power plant. How did it start? In 2009, the campaign really started. Think about 2008. All the leaders in the world is really the only thing they worry about is global financial crisis, right? How did it start? It really was because the U.S. Exim Bank's new restrictions in 2009. And this restriction is started as a response to a lawsuit brought by the environmental groups. It's financed on the coal-fired power plants and how it caused the environmental degradation. In response to this lawsuit, who actually ruled the loss of that U.S. Exim and also forced them to change some of their environmental guidance. So it imposed new rules to ban high carbon intensive projects and also asked them for a higher transparency measures in doing their environmental impact assessment. Actually, proposed rule even include to impose carbon capture and storage technologies required for all other coal power plants. So if you have some background about what carbon capture storage technology, also known as CCS, you will know it is practically banning almost all the coal-fired power projects in the world. This is a very advanced technology and very expensive. That is almost impossible for most of the developing countries to acquire without heavy subsidies. Basically, the 2009 campaign, the Obama administration tried to use this new U.S. Exim Bank rules, the coal-fired power plants, and tried to convince all the other OECD ECAs to follow and adopt the same rules very quickly. Everybody think this is impractical. Especially this is the time, the financial crisis and exports are very important for everybody in terms of economic recovery. So very quickly, nobody responded except for, Nordic countries. They believe that this is something not really hurting their economy and their export interests very much. And also it fall into their environmental prioritization. So the 2009 campaign very quickly vanished. And in 2012, when Obama administration come out with a very strong climate policy, Nordic country very quickly on board, and then United Kingdoms and Canada, they're among the earliest respond to Obama administrations and also come out with joint announcement to end their export credit agencies on overseas coal power finance. And then others, such as World Bank and the European Investment Bank, also follow suit in adopting this new rule. who are the biggest players resisting these rules? Japan and also South Korea and also Australia, who are among the largest coal exporters in the world. Although they are not a coal technology exporters, but Australia, you know, they are the one that benefit the largest from coal exports. So they are the one resisting this 2012 coal-fired power campaign. They are also known as the Coal Alliance within the OECD countries in this negotiation.
With the pushback from Obama's 2012 climate agenda at the OECD from Japan, South Korea, and Australia, what were the outcomes from the negotiation?
So Obama administration, you know, asked all the other OECD countries to follow and adopt U.S. Exim Bank's new rules on coal-fired power plant, the requirement of the CCS technology. It really encountered a lot of pushbacks. They're calling this unrealistic. And so Japan and South Korea, especially Japan, who are, you know, the largest player in this area, they counter this request. The biggest discourse that the Japanese government is using is that they believe that the developing countries still have very important, you know, reliance on affordable energy supply. And coal is still the most important, you know, source for them. And they believe there is a practical reason to do so. And CCS, given its high price and also the technology level, that is still not mature enough for mass production and also, you know, for most developing countries to afford. So they believe this is not the best requirement. But really, what is preventing them from accepting Obama administration's request is China. Think about this. If I remember, there are people that I interview, give me this direct quote from them saying that, if we don't do this, China will do it. So, you know, basically, this is a competition, you know, the market competition that they are, you know, if the OECD is forced them to empty this market, China will quickly fill in. So that make them very reluctant to do so. And the compromise is really that, you know, Japan decided to offer a restriction that is not a higher restriction in terms of the greenhouse emissions of the coal-fired power plants to replace the requirement of the CCS technology for coal power plants. The outcome of the negotiations for the OECD negotiations in 2015 is really a compromise between the U.S. version and the Japanese version. So essentially, the U.S. Exim Bank's rule of requirement of CCS technology is not mentioned in the negotiation. Instead, is that the requirement of the ultra supercritical filter for the coal-fired power plant is required for most of the large-scale coal power plants. So basically, at that time, that ruled out 85% of the coal-fired power plants under construction or to be constructioned in the developing countries. But if you look into the greenhouse emissions, requirement of the ultra supercritical power plants is really not enough in terms of achieving Paris Agreement's goal in reducing the carbon emissions. But this is the compromise. So you can see this is the reality of the power struggles between United States and Japan.
And it wasn't there a really large buildup of non-ultra supercritical coal plants coming from South Korea and Japan, like 2 years running up to when this OECD new rule went in?
Right. There was also a grandfather clause installed in the 2015 OECD negotiations. So that allow OECD ECAs to continue financing some of those power plants. And so this is something that's still up for contestation, right? Like if you ask Japan and South Korea, if you are, you know, actually abusing the OECD negotiation or you're still just following what the grandfather clause allows you to do, they say they comply with it. This is just like one of the, you know, some of those projects are already in the pipeline, feasibility studies already done, and the money is already going in. And therefore, you know, we're just kind of like wrapping up the project. But others believe that because of the grandfather clause, they have a lot of incentives to really fast track a lot of the due diligence process, and including the environment impact assessments and feasibility studies and all that in order to meet the grandfather clause. So depending on who you ask, and you will get like different answers. But nevertheless, Japan and South Korea will tell you all those projects are still in compliance with what the 2015 negotiations allowed. But if you look into those projects from the perspective of meeting Paris Agreement's goal, you will see this is really not helping us, if not making it hard to achieve the Paris Agreement. Those are like major projects that will lock in those developing countries' greenhouse emissions for years to come.
So yeah, I think that what this piece really laid out for me is when we think of China as getting involved in or choosing not to get involved in these global institutions like the OECD, which it is not a member of, it, you know, the question of does it complement or compete with Western-led institutions? And your answer is kind of that the fact that China was this huge funder of coal-fired power plants mm-hmm. and it was not part of this agreement meant that the resistance to the U.S. suggestion of controlling investments in coal was strengthened by the specter of competition from China and the fact that China would fund these coal-powered plants, even if Japan or South Korea wasn't, right?
That's right. That's right. The really interesting thing that is going on very recently after my piece was accepted by Global Policy, there are a lot of things that are still ongoing, including with Japan and South Korea's ECAs. So because of those continuing financing of those power plants that we were talking about, they're under a lot of pressure from not just environmental groups, but the national image of Japan and South Korean governments financing overseas coal-fired power plants. So South Korean government recently announced they are going to end voluntarily, you know, they're going OECD arrangement plus agreement. They say they're going to end all the overseas coal-fired power plant. And that is putting a lot of pressure on Japanese export credit agencies. So the Japanese export credit agencies also reluctantly hinted that they're going to, you know, consider that. Mm-hmm. So far, although they're not, you know, signing anything on paper saying that they're not going to do it, but they've been verbally committed to end any kind of overseas power plant financing. Oh, now all the pressure is going onto the Chinese ECAs. They're very tiptoeing on this subject right now. So right. It seems like Exim China and also CDB have been like pause all their finance to the overseas coal-fired power plants since this year.
Interesting. That's a huge development.
Very interesting. Yeah, this is a positive development. It needs continual observation,
right?
Because we are seeing that the three countries' ECAs are still not really putting very clear turn on what they're going to do with this, you know, sector. So depends on what is happening. But there are certain rules are coming out. Not rules. When we're talking about rules in China, it's actually more like guidance or opinions. We call it soft rules, but there are some like proposals that are coming out in China recently. I talked to like Beijing-based folks in this area. Chinese government are actually considering a proposal. They call it a traffic light system for all the overseas financing projects. They're trying to put it in three categories, and some categories are the brown categories, that the most polluting and the most environmentally detrimental categories. And that will be also the one that will have the hardest time and the highest restrictions for export credit agencies to consider. Coal power plant is fall into that category. But all those new rules are all opinions and proposals, nothing really forcible.
Right, nothing binding yet. You know, it's so interesting because I do want to move us to the Your Panda Paw article because it reflects some really fascinating research you've been doing that I think is similar to this in that when we think of climate change, you really need this collective action happening. So the OECD kind of agreement that the Obama administration was pioneering, they were hyper-reliant on collective action, on agreement across countries. And it sounds like really interesting to hear that it might swing back towards the restrictions on coal fire power plant right. funding. But in your PandaPaw article, you talk a lot more about high-speed rail construction and Chinese and Japanese investments. And for me, it's such a great example that gives more nuance to how controlling ECAs is a double-sided sword, right? Part of mm-hmm. why governments want to do it is because they don't want to race to throwing cheap credit, basically, around the world, because it also brings some problems that are... So one side, I think the climate change side, is ensuring certain types of quality or certain standards for what kind of export projects get funded. And then this other side, which I think Eric has some great questions for, the other side is kind of trying to make sure that those projects are high quality. So I'll hand it over to Eric then.
In your Journal of Contemporary Politics article, you write about how politically motivated infrastructure competition, infrastructure diplomacy between regional hegemons and smaller states can actually create negative outcomes for that recipient country. A dominant IR theory talks about hedging, where, you know, logically a smaller state can play two dominant powers against each other in order to gain agency and gain positive concessions from both. Within this article, you showcase between China-Japan infrastructure competition in Indonesia, but you share how this politically motivated infrastructure competition can create a system that has negative outcomes for recipient country. How is that?
So, yeah, I think it's really interesting. When Jakarta-Bandung high-speed railroad first came into line in 2015, all the reports and articles and studies done by think tanks or academic or whatever policy circle is really all focused on geopolitical, geoeconomic competition. Really little focus is on what is the political economic effect on the borrowing countries, and also how is that effect, actually interact with the domestic context of the borrowing countries. And this is something that I'm interested in explore. And there's also another dimension that is often being left out of the discussion is creditor competition. If we look at creditor competition in the history, you will see that this windfall effect is usually not playing very well on the borrowing country side. So creditor competitions, when you think about it, if lender A and lender B, they both have, because they have a lot of monies in hand, and their job is really to push out those monies. Otherwise, they're just idling. And when they're idle, when their money is idling, they're actually losing money. So they have pressure to really just give out. That sounds like a great situation for people who need that money, who need to borrow money, right? But then a windfall effect that, benefits the borrowing countries, because in our assumption is they give them greater access to financial resources and better terms and a better negotiation, positions to get a better terms as well. But then this easy access to financing can also motivate political opportunism or decision makers in those borrowing countries and use those foreign sponsored projects or foreign capitals to enhance their political positions rather than making sound policy choices. The borrowers are not just borrowing or not just purchasing because of this great product. It's because they are using this product to achieve some kind of political projects or to advance their political interests. But then, this outcome is actually, a political interest achieved, but at the cost of the public or say the taxpayer. And this is what we see. We trying to, lay out with this high-speed railroad project in Indonesia.
Bring us into the example a little bit of the high-speed rail development in Indonesia. You talk about this interplay between China and Japan as creditors, and then the way in which Indonesia's domestic political landscape also ends up shaping the rail project.
The official name of this project is called Jakarta-Bandung High-Speed Railway Project. So the project has a convoluted history. In the previous administration, during the SBY government, the project was on the sidelines of several development plans drawn up in collaboration between Jakarta and the Japan International Cooperation Agency, JICA. and it was merely considered as an alternative route for a larger HSR plan between Jakarta and Surabaya. And because of Japanese ministry's mixed assessment over the project's financial viability and the Indonesian government's physical caution, the project never gained political traction. But then the scenes began to change, first because Shinzo Abe came back as the Japanese prime minister in late 2012 and started pushing for the infrastructure diplomacy with HSR the focal point. So this kind of new focus on overseas high-speed railroad promotion really started to reboost this project. In 2014, JICA had designated the HSR project, Jakarta-Bandung HSR, as a new initiative in its Overseas Development Aid, ODA, plan for Indonesia, and also agreeing to financing it along with the private Japanese consortium under the Jakarta's financial guarantee. But then it came Jokowi's in 2014's presidential victory. Soon after his inauguration, Jokowi vowed to lift the Indonesian economy through the ambitious infrastructure plan. And this infrastructure plan has over hundreds of big and small infrastructure projects with an estimated cost of $470 billion. So it was a huge infrastructure push. But then the skepticism of this project is everywhere because of the short time frame on one hand, and also because the rupiah's depreciation and Jakarta's physical limit, also a host of institutional problems on the other side. And when Jokowi slashed a few subsidies to support infrastructure budgets, soaring gasoline and diesel prices heightened criticism for this policy, and you see Jokowi's approval rating plummeted. So what is really clear, though, is that the dynamic shift since Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit to Jakarta in 2015. And you see Jokowi realize that very important moment for them to actually gain support from China in pushing for its infrastructure big push. Realizing the opportunity posed by Japan and China competition over the infrastructure investment in the region, Jokowi actively made rounds between China and Japan in seeking for its infrastructure big push. And China was pretty generous in pushing for some of those projects and helping, you know, pledge to finance a lot of the important projects for Jokowi. But then there is a very important condition that China is asking for. At first, there was a lot of hesitations and concerns from even its own administrations. They were thinking this is a project that has been long developed with Japan. But then in order to woo China, the Jokowi administration still invited China to send in its feasibility studies and also to give in its proposal. And China was very aggressive in, you know, making itself competitive. So you see this process that is a very much a competition, a creditor competition that is ongoing. So it come in with a really more, you know, price competitive package and also a shorter timeline of construction. And then in response, Japan also pledged a 50% reduction of its state guarantee from Indonesia for this HSR project. And when Jokowi turned down both deals because Indonesia is under this legalized physical debt limit, so it was really just bar a Jakarta to take either side's financing offer. China altogether waived the state guarantee entirely and proposed a contract that is between the two countries' state-owned enterprises in order to help circumvent the debt limit. So Indonesia very quickly awarded China the project under this so-called investment contract that would not incur any kind of public debt. So Jakarta-Bandung High-Speed Railway then become the first project out of Jokowi's big push infrastructure plan that to break ground.
It's also fascinating because it exemplifies two narratives that are outside of the mainstream perception of China's Belt and Road, right? One is this idea that when you don't have these agreements that the Obama administration was trying to put in place, or that, you know, the OECD has done since the 70s of putting restrictions and standards on export lending, you can also have a race to the bottom of the creditors, right? And then this other idea that there's a lot of agency in terms of the Indonesian government in this equation, even though China and Japan are big heavy hitters when it comes to, you know, their global economic might. Shinzo Abe is saying to his exporters, like, I really want to focus on high speed rail, get this project approved in Indonesia. And then the Chinese are saying, like, oh, you know, you don't want to fund this publicly. Great. We're just going to be accepting of any type of finance that you can provide us, which ends up being Indonesian state-owned enterprise, kind of like hyper unreliable finance. It's a great kind of alternative narrative to what you hear, such a focus on Chinese Belt and Road portrayals.
That's right. And when we think about like high-speed rail export, at least like what China and Japanese, you know, political narrative, like official narratives, they're trying to paint this as a representation of quality infrastructure or whatnot. But if you look into these detail, there's really a lot of question marks. How sound it is, like how feasible it is for this kind of high quality infrastructure. If you look into its feasibility studies, and if you look into the environmental assessments and all that, a lot of it is really, I don't want to say it, but it really looks like a practice of race to the bottom. But like the financial bottom, right? You know, like, yeah, lower the financial limitations and restrictions in order to make it work.
Yeah, I remember at some point you say that the Chinese, after the Japanese say that they're not going to fund the project because they don't think it's financially feasible, the Chinese completed their feasibility study in 3 months and their environmental impact assessment in 7 days, which is...
That's right.
I mean, yeah, this is not like an agricultural plantation like I study. This is a high-speed rail development that's like a flagship project for Indonesia.
Right.
Yeah. So Jessica, I think this is great. By way of a conclusion, I just want to flag that, you know, your research presents a really good response to the label of China as practicing debt trap diplomacy. You never actually used this term yourself in the articles that we've read, but, you know, what do you think your research says to that label, and how do you show that financing ties are a lot more complicated? I think you used the phrase a two-way street in earlier conversations. Right.
I purposely try to avoid the term debt trap diplomacy because I feel like this is a term to a certain extent out of social engineering, probably fit into certain government narrative discourse. But it is really concerning when we're thinking about like unsound financial instrument and also unsound planning of all those massive infrastructure plans. And there is a debt trap, but debt trap is a two-way street. That is not something that the creditors or like Chinese lenders are able to achieve unless there is a demand, the demand from the borrowing side that is interested in loaning all this money from the Chinese lenders. And why are they interested in doing so? The political opportunity can range from the electoral gains, political clients, any kind of bribery-related activities in general, or even just a political aspiration. It's really interesting. Like politicians love attending those ribbon cutting ceremonies. It just makes them feel they are so important and so special. They're doing a lot of great things. And infrastructure projects somehow just create all those ceremonial
experiences.
Exactly. And this is a way that for them, like the really easy and the straightforward way for them to, you know, convince their constituents they're doing great job taking care of them, providing public service and public goods and all that. But what they do not know and not easy to perceive is that there is a consequence for years or even decades to come to recover. And it's very difficult if you do not have a very strong institution to check those politicians. It's easy for them to just use all those opportunities to do so when the financial opportunities are available. Having said that, I think debt trap is a two-way street that really requires lenders, the creditors, to take the first initiative. So what I'm saying, I'm still turning back to, you know, big financial providers such as like China and Japan. and also among all the other countries who are lenders of the developing countries. They have responsibility to think of the consequences that they are creating. And I know this is very contradicting because a lot of it is about statecraft practice, right? They have like political calculations. So a lot of time, financially sound decisions is not their first priority. But think about it, if you're over subsidy or you're often doing it for the political purposes, the debt trap is also going to hurt their own physical health as well. So I would say that the lending countries, the credit countries, have responsibilities to really take more precautions of making their financial decisions more sound. And you start to see the trend is starting to change. Since the G20 summit in Osaka, you see that Japan and China, they are making a more, you know, awareness of how the credit competitions can cause problems on not just the borrowing country side, the credit country side. So they are agreeing on more cooperation instead of competitions on overseas infrastructure financing. And they're still trying to iron out to what extent in what area they should cooperate. But I think you see the export credit finance competition is start to decrease because the outcome is, you know, starting to pinch them.
Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. It's been so lovely to have you on the show, Jessica. Will you stick around for recommendations?
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Belt and Road podcast. Our guest today, again, is Dr. Jessica Liao. Remember, if you want to follow more conversations like this, the latest news, updates, and analysis on the Belt and Road Initiative, you can follow us on our Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod. Now let's go to recommendations. Jessica, do you have any recommendations for our listeners today?
I do have a recommendation. This new book written by Yifei Li and Judith Shapiro called China Goes Green, Coercive Environmentalism for a Troubled Planet. This is a really fascinating observation of what happened over the past decades in China's move to environmental transformation. And what they show is they basically, you know, question this notion of coercive environmentalism, or other people call it authoritarian environmentalism. Since China, you know, moved from the sidelight to the center stage of the global environmental governance, particularly on the climate issue. A lot of people were wondering if there is a model called authoritarian environmentalism, where the government have to be more strong-headed in order to push its citizens, as well as the whole governmental apparatus, to move to green. And Yifei Li and Judith Shapiro is telling us this is really not the best, not a good advice if you look deeper into the problems that China has been grappling with. And they show with very detailed empirical studies to prove that China's environmental transformation only work the best when they open their system and listen to all kinds of stakeholders, like, you know, scholars, environmentalists, scientists, and all that, and try to take in their advice and in order to have a more aggressive regulatory or industrial transformation. But once they close down and restrict all those input, you start to see the stagnation of their environmental change. And that's a really interesting observation and conclusion. And I think it's worthwhile to read into.
Yeah, I just saw a webcast of the book opening, and I have been really meaning to read the book. Yeah, I only remember, and I don't have tons of the details of it, but my very personal anecdotal experience of, I imagine they're talking about as authoritarian environmentalism, when I was in the Peace Corps in Guizhou, next to my campus, which is in the outskirts of this coal town in western Guizhou. There was semi-dilapidated village area. Of course, it was all torn down and under like a sponge city idea to make a wetlands park, which finally actually made like a nice river and stream and like a beautiful little park with nice plants and stuff. But thousands of people were displaced from their homes and moved across the street to high rises, even though they kind of farmed and tilled the land, which it's a pretty common story throughout China. But Juliet, how about yourself?
Yeah, so I've been having to do some catch up reading over this break, stepping back from immediate projects and thinking a little bit more about China in the capitalist system. And I've been reading Adam Smith in Beijing. It's a book by Giovanni Arrighi, who's an economic historian. And It came out in 2009. And so it's this really fascinating snapshot of someone who studies, you know, the history of capitalism and is talking about China's extraordinary rise before like Xi Jinping takes over and before at this moment when just after the global economic crisis, when I think a lot of people started questioning their faith in the Western kind of hegemonic system of liberal democracy. And we're looking at China in really positive light. And so it's really strange reading this over 10 years later. But I think it's a good reflective kind of project of looking at what he wrote about China back in 2009. So that's been thought-provoking for me, and I'm trying to figure out how recent changes put it in perspective.
Yeah, certainly have to read that book. For me, speaking of export credit agencies, I somehow stumbled upon a segment of the Hugh Hewitt show. Hugh Hewitt, if you don't know, is a right-wing Trumpian radio host who's not as awful as the, you know, Glenn Becks or Ben Shapiro's of the world. He's, I guess, respectable enough. So like MSNBC tries to get him on to be the conservative Trumpian voice of reason. But, you know, it's still right wing talk radio. But he had an interview with the chairman of the U.S. Export Import Bank. And he talked about how he really supports and always supported the U.S. Export Import Bank. And how, you know, Newt Gingrich is fully on board, and how, you know, this kind of plunge into the reopening of the U.S. Export-Import Bank and the International Development Finance Corporation, really with the sole purpose deliberately stated of like competing with China, and how these very free market fundamentalists for this competition towards China have now fully embraced overseas industrial policy. So just understanding American right-wing Trumpian world, but then also with the export credit agency mindset in line, it's a fascinating interview, which included saying that it was Chairman Kimberly Reed said that Trump himself was the one who said we need to get a larger budget for the Export-Import Bank in order to compete with China.
But this is super fascinating because not too long ago, but they are very overlapping with the Tea Party. And, you know, the Tea Partiers actually back in 2000, you know, early 2010, are the one who almost paralyzed export credit agencies of U.S., right? Because they think this is a, you know, agency that subsidizes and, you know, takes like taxpayers' monies to like help the big corporates, and they do not want to fund it. And actually, one of the reasons that United States lose power in controlling and in swaying others to have a tighter rule on export credit agencies is because U.S. is just not have the market power that used to have in the 70s and 80s. When they can do a power throwdown, because we have like a much bigger public coffer, and they call it like war chest, right? To really do a subsidy war. And then really eventually got people, specifically, I'm talking about like France and also Japan, to like come into line and say, let's have an agreement. And with the losing power of our Exim Bank, and especially during 2011 to 2015, they are pretty much because they use the congressional power to not fill in the board of the Exim Bank. So that basically, you know, ban the bank from financing any projects above, I believe, 10 million. So that is a very small amount of money they are operating under. So, and if you look at like, you know, the previous report from Export Credit, like from US Exim, they're really not doing enough to write any annual report. And instead, they're starting writing reports about other export credit agencies.
Well, it is wild on that note. I mean, they're certainly going past 10 million now. I I can't believe it's not bigger news, but maybe it's just because I exist in a very small segment of Twitter that cares about this stuff. But, you know, the U.S. Export-Import Bank, I can't remember how much of the $5 billion that they're funding to a giant LNG plant in Mozambique. They just closed an $8 billion deal for a nuclear power plant in Romania. Well, it's the U.S. IDFC has put $1 billion into Indonesia. U.S. is never going to be able to compete for many different reasons on a project-by-project basis to China, nor should they really. But it is just interesting how with this right-wing Cold War mindset of anti-China has brought about these free market fundamentalists to create an overseas industrial policy. So listen to this interview. Well, this has been a really fun conversation. Thank you so much for joining us in the Belt Road Podcast. And Jessica, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you.